Chapter 3. Modesty will not allow it. It is to be remarked of his trade that it is a very fascinating one. He never leaves it, and those who are near to him become smitten with a love of it too, and sooner or later set up for themselves. He employs a messenger man, woman, or child. That messenger is certain ultimately to become an independent begging letter writer. His sons and daughters succeed to his calling and write begging letters when he is no more. He throws off the infection of begging letter writing like the contagion of disease. What Sidney Smith so happily called the dangerous luxury of dishonesty is more tempting and more catching, it would seem, in this instance than in any other. He always belongs to a corresponding society of begging letter writers. Anyone who will, may ascertain this fact. Give money today in recognition of a begging letter, no matter how unlike a common begging letter, and for the next fortnight you will have a rush of such communications. Steadily refuse to give, and the begging letters become angels' visits, until the society is from some cause or other in a dull way of business, and may as well try you as anybody else. It is of little use inquiring into the begging letter writer's circumstances. He may be sometimes accidentally found out, as in the case already mentioned, though that was not the first inquiry made, but apparent misery is always a part of his trade, and real misery very often is, in the intervals of spring lamb and early asparagus. It is naturally an incident of his dissipated and dishonest life. That the calling is a successful one, and that large sums of money are gained by it, must be evident to anybody who reads the police reports of such cases. But, prosecutions are of rare occurrence, relatively to the extent to which the trade is carried on. The cause of this is to be found, as no one knows better than the begging letter writer, for it is a part of his speculation, in the aversion people feel to exhibit themselves as having been imposed upon, or as having weakly gratified their consciences with a lazy, flimsy substitute for the noblest of all virtues. There is a man at large, at the moment when this paper is preparing for the press, on the 29th of April, 1850, and never once taken up yet, who, within these 12 months, has been probably the most audacious and the most successful swindler that even this trade has ever known. There has been something singularly base in this fellow's proceedings. It has been his business to write to all sorts and conditions of people, in the names of persons of high reputation and unblemished honor, professing to be in distress the general admiration and respect for whom has ensured a ready and generous reply. Now, in the hope that the results of the real experience of a real person may do something more to induce reflection on this subject than any abstract treatise, and with a personal knowledge of the extent to which the begging letter trade has been carried on for some time, and has been for some time constantly increasing, the writer of this paper entreats the attention of his readers to a few concluding words. His experience is a type of the experience of many, some on a smaller, some on an infinitely larger scale. All may judge of the soundness or unsoundness of his conclusions from it. Long doubtful of the efficacy of such assistance in any case whatever, and able to recall but one, within his whole individual knowledge, in which he had the least after reason to suppose that any good was done by it, he was led, last autumn, into some serious considerations. The begging letters flying about by every post made it perfectly manifest that a set of lazy vagabonds were interposed between the general desire to do something to relieve the sickness and misery under which the poor were suffering, and the suffering poor themselves. That many who sought to do some little to repair the social wrongs inflicted in the way of preventable sickness and death upon the poor were strengthening those wrongs, however innocently, by wasting money on pestilent knaves cumbering society. That imagination, soberly following one of these knaves into his life of punishment in jail, and comparing it with the life of one of these poor in a cholera-stricken alley, or one of the children of one of these poor, soothed in its dying hour by the late lamented Mr. Drowett, contemplated a grim farce, impossible to be presented very much longer before God or man. That the crowning miracle of all the miracles summed up in the New Testament, after the miracle of the blind seeing, and the lame walking, and the restoration of the dead to life, was the miracle that the poor had the gospel preached to them. That while the poor were unnaturally and unnecessarily cut off by the thousand, in the prematurity of their age, or in the rottenness of their youth, for of flower or blossom such youth as none, the gospel was not preached to them, saving in hollow and unmeaning voices. That of all wrongs, this was the first mighty wrong the pestilence warned us to set right. And that no post office order to any amount, given to a begging letter writer for the quieting of an uneasy breast, would be presentable on the last great day as anything towards it. The poor never write these letters. Nothing could be more unlike their habits. The writers are public robbers, and we who support them are parties to their depredations. They trade upon every circumstance within their knowledge that affects us, public or private, joyful or sorrowful. They pervert the lessons of our lives. They change what ought to be our strength and virtue into weakness and encouragement of vice. There is a plain remedy, and it is in our own hands. We must resolve, at any sacrifice of feeling, to be deaf to such appeals, and crush the trade. There are degrees in murder. Life must be held sacred among us in more ways than one sacred, not merely from the murderous weapon, or the subtle poison, or the cruel blow, but sacred from preventable diseases, distortions, and pains. That is the first great end we have to set against this miserable imposition. Physical life respected, moral life comes next. What will not content a begging letter writer for a week, would educate a score of children for a year. Let us give all we can. Let us give more than ever. Let us do all we can. Let us do more than ever. But let us give, and do, with a high purpose, not to endow the scum of the earth, to its own greater corruption, with the offals of our duty. A child's dream of a star. There was once a child, and he strolled about a good deal, and thought of a number of things. He had a sister, who was a child too, and his constant companion. These two used to wonder all day long. They wondered at the beauty of the flowers. They wondered at the height and blueness of the sky. They wondered at the depth of the bright water. They wondered at the goodness and the power of God who made the lovely world. They used to say to one another, sometimes, supposing all the children upon earth were to die, would the flowers, and the water, and the sky be sorry? They believed they would be sorry. For, said they, the buds are the children of the flowers, and the little playful streams that gambol down the hillsides are the children of the water, and the smallest bright specks playing at tide, and seek in the sky all night, must surely be the children of the stars. And they would all be grieved to see their playmates, the children of men, no more. There was one clear shining star that used to come out in the sky before the rest, near the church spire, above the graves. It was larger and more beautiful, they thought, than all the others, and every night they watched for it, standing hand in hand at a window. Whoever saw it first cried out, "I see the star!" Apostrophe, apostrophe, and often they cried out both together, knowing so well when it would rise, and where. So they grew to be such friends with it, that, before lying down in their beds, they always looked out once again, to bid it good night, and when they were turning round to sleep, they used to say, "God bless the star!" Apostrophe, apostrophe, but while she was still very young, oh, very, very young, the sister drooped, and came to be so weak, that she could no longer stand in the window at night. And then the child looked sadly out by himself, and when he saw the star, turned round and said to the patient pale face on the bed, "I see the star." Apostrophe, apostrophe, and then a smile would come upon the face, and a little weak voice used to say, "God bless my brother and the star." Apostrophe, apostrophe, and so the time came all too soon. When the child looked out alone, and when there was no face on the bed, and when there was a little grave among the graves, not there before, and when the star made long rays down towards him, as he saw it through his tears. Now, these rays were so bright, and they seemed to make such a shining way from earth to heaven, that when the child went to his solitary bed, he dreamed about the star, and dreamed that, lying where he was, he saw a train of people taken up that sparkling road by angels. And the star, opening, showed him a great world of light, where many more such angels waited to receive them. All these angels, who were waiting, turned their beaming eyes upon the people who were carried up into the star, and some came out from the long rows in which they stood, and fell upon the people's necks, and kissed them tenderly, and went away with them down avenues of light, and were so happy in their company, that lying in his bed he wept for joy. But, there were many angels who did not go with them, and among them one he knew. The patient face that once had lain upon the bed, was glorified and radiant, but his heart found out his sister among all the host. His sister's angel lingered near the entrance of the star, and said to the leader among those who had brought the people thither, "Is my brother come?" And he said no. She was turning hopefully away, when the child stretched out his arms, and cried, "Oh, sister, I am here. Take me." And then she turned her beaming eyes upon him, and it was night, and the star was shining into the room, making long rays down towards him as he saw it through his tears. From that hour forth, the child looked out upon the star, as on the home he was to go to, when his time should come, and he thought that he did not belong to the earth alone, but to the star too, because of his sister's angel gone before. There was a baby born to be a brother to the child, and while he was so little that he never yet had spoken word, he stretched his tiny form out on his bed, and died. Again the child dreamed of the open star, and of the company of angels, and the train of people, and the rows of angels with their beaming eyes all turned upon those people's faces. Said his sister's angel to the leader, "Is my brother come?" And he said, "Not that one, but another." As the child beheld his brother's angel in her arms, he cried, "Oh, sister, I am here. Take me." And she turned and smiled upon him, and the star was shining. He grew to be a young man, and was busy at his books, when an old servant came to him and said, "Thy mother is no more. I bring her blessing on her darling son." Again at night he saw the star, and all that former company. Said his sister's angel to the leader, "Is my brother come?" And he said, "Thy mother." A mighty cry of joy went forth through all the star, because the mother was reunited to her two children. And he stretched out his arms and cried, "Oh, mother, sister, and brother, I am here. Take me." And they answered him, "Not yet." And the star was shining. He grew to be a man, whose hair was turning gray, and he was sitting in his chair by the fireside, heavy with grief, and with his face bedewed with tears, when the star opened once again. Said his sister's angel to the leader, "Is my brother come?" And he said, "Nay, but his maiden daughter." And the man who had been the child saw his daughter, newly lost to him, a celestial creature among those three, and he said, "My daughter's head is on my sister's bosom, and her arm is around my mother's neck, and at her feet there is the baby of old time, and I can bear the parting from her, God be praised." And the star was shining. Thus the child came to be an old man, and his once smooth face was wrinkled, and his steps were slow and feeble, and his back was bent. And one night as he lay upon his bed, his children standing round, he cried, as he had cried so long ago, "I see the star." They whispered one another, "He is dying." And he said, "I am. My age is falling from me like a garment, and I move towards the star as a child. And oh, my father, now I thank thee, that it has so often opened, to receive those dear ones who await me." And the star was shining, and it shines upon his grave. Our English watering place, In the autumn time of the year, when the great metropolis is so much hotter, so much noisier, so much more moldy, or so much more water-carted, so much more crowded, so much more disturbing and distracting in all respects, than it usually is, a quiet sea beach becomes indeed a blessed spot. Half awake and half asleep, this idle morning in our sunny window on the edge of a chalk cliff in the old-fashioned watering place to which we are a faithful resorter, we feel a lazy inclination to sketch its picture. The place seems to respond. Sky, sea, beach, and village lie as still before us, as if they were sitting for the picture. It is dead low water. A ripple plays among the ripening corn upon the cliff, as if it were faintly trying from recollection to imitate the sea, and the world of butterflies hovering over the crop of radish seed are as restless in their little way as the gulls are in their larger manner when the wind blows. But the ocean lies winking in the sunlight like a drowsy lion, its glassy waters scarcely curve upon the shore. The fishing boats in the tiny harbor are all stranded in the mud. Our two colliers are watering place has a maritime trade employing that amount of shipping, of not an inch of water within a quarter of a mile of them, and turn, exhausted, on their sides, like faint fish of an antediluvian species. Rusty cables and chains, ropes and rings, under most parts of posts and piles, and confused timber defenses against the waves, lie strewn about, in a brown litter of tangled seaweed, and fallen cliff which looks as if a family of giants had been making tea here for ages, and had observed an untidy custom of throwing their tea leaves on the shore. In truth, our watering place itself has been left somewhat high and Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.